Well, I really hope that by the end of this series, Rick will truly be able to say he still is a great guy. Thank you all for being here this morning. I am thankful to have the opportunity to speak for you this today and the next couple days about owning your faith. I appreciate the invitation to come back with you and to spend some time with you. I really got a lot out of my time with you as a trainee here working under Ron and getting to know all of you and your encouragement. So just thank you for the invitation to be here and thank you for the time that we've already spent together. Got a lot of things I'd like to say to you this morning, so I'm just going to jump right in here and get started. We're going to begin this morning by talking about owning our faith in God. This morning we laid something of a foundation about what it means to own our faith and why we need to do that and the attitudes that we need to have as we own our faith. But as we get more specifics, let's talk about why we should believe in God. This is really the most fundamental place as we begin thinking about our faith. I mean, what is more important than our faith in God? It's the most fundamental point of who we are. If there is no God, as we just saying that there is one, if there is no God, then why even be here today? If there is no God, there are logical consequences that come from that. On the other hand, if there is a God, the great I am, the supreme authority, the almighty God, if he exists, then of course we need to be here today to worship him. And there are logical consequences that come from there being a God. So we're going to begin here this morning with talking about owning our faith in God. What I'd like to do this morning is just ask you to think about three reasons to believe in God. But before we do that, I want to make just some introductory remarks and get to one point in particular. From the Bible's perspective, the fact that God exists is really just a given. I mean, if you open up to the very first verse in the Bible, Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, it says, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." You don't find any explanation of how God began, how God got there, who this God is. All you have is just the statement that in the beginning, God was, and he created everything. You don't find the Bible laying out any, you know, logical explanation for who God is, or rather, how he came to be, or why we should believe in him. All you have is just, you have a few passages to talk about the fact that he created everything and that from that we should conclude that there is a God. But from the Bible's perspective, the fact that God is just assumed. Almost as if it's so obvious that we ought to just accept it. But of course we know that we live in a skeptical world where there's a lot of doubt, a lot of skepticism about God's existence. And so it's very good for us to think about, why should we believe in God's existence? The first problem, the big problem I think we have when we come to thinking about faith in God, is we have to understand what faith really is. Because a lot of people begin their journey thinking about God with a faulty definition of what faith really is. They might define faith as something like this, that faith is blind, unreasonable belief in something without evidence. That faith is something that you accept regardless of common sense, regardless of the rational evidence, the verifiable objective evidence that we have for us. In other words, faith, from a lot of people's perspective, is defined as irrational, something that logic and evidence does not support. From a lot of people's perspective, we're foolish for believing in God. Atheists for a long time have defined faith in this way. For example, Richard Dawkins, who is a very militant atheist, he's an evolutionary biologist, but he writes that faith is the great cop-out, the great excuse to evade the need to think and evaluate evidence. Faith is belief in spite of, or perhaps because of, the lack of evidence. In another place he says, "Religious faith does not depend on rational justification. Religion demands unquestioned faith." In other words, if you want to have faith, you have to have the kind of faith that would lead you to blindly drink this poison Kool-Aid. You know, that's what faith is. It's completely opposite of rationality. But this definition of faith is not just something that you find in atheists or many scientists or intellectuals. It's a definition that you find even in our own culture today. So much in our culture, in fact, in our tradition. You ever seen the movie Miracle on 34th Street? It's a classic Christmas movie that's about believing in Santa Claus. And there's a quote in that movie which really stood out to me when I've seen it. And it says, "Faith is believing when common sense tells you not to." Now, to some extent, I think that definition really resonates with us because it's sentimental, makes us feel good. We like to have things to believe in, things that we can say that we believe in. But if we define faith in this way as totally opposite of what common sense tells us, then by this definition, there is just as much evidence for God as there is for the Tooth Fairy, as there is for Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny, or the Flying Spaghetti Monster. I'm not making this up now. The Flying Spaghetti Monster is this theoretical idea of God in atheist minds. But we must not buy into this definition of faith. But sometimes even Christians define faith in this way. Sad to say, I've heard some Christians who believe in God make statements like, "God is whatever you feel." And maybe I understand where they're coming from when they say that, but it kind of sounds like they're saying, well, you don't need any reasons to believe in God. All you need is just this feeling in your heart, and you can define faith with however you want to, and he's just however you feel. Or I've heard other statements like, faith is believing in things you can't see. Now, that to some extent is true. In fact, when you go to the passage that was read for us a few minutes ago, Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1, it says, "Faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen." So yes, faith to some extent involves believing in things that we cannot see. But what's the foundation of that faith? Where does that faith or that trust, where does that assurance come from? It's Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1 isn't defining faith as wishful thinking, so to speak, but it's defining faith as belief or trusting in things that you can't see because of the things that you can see. For example, in Hebrews 11, verse 3, it talks about the creation of the world. It says, "By faith we understand that the worlds were prepared by the word of God, so that what is seen was not made out of things which are visible." Those things that we see around us, those are the things that God has left us as the evidence, as the reason for believing in the God that we cannot see. And the examples that Hebrews goes on to give about Abraham and Noah and all these examples of faith, they weren't blindly following God in the sense that they had no reason to trust in God. They had every reason to trust in him. If God told you, spoke directly to you, and told you to build a giant box to float you and a bunch of animals in, would you believe in him? If God appeared to you and told you you and your wife were going to have a child, even though you were well beyond the age of childbirth, and that actually happened, would you believe in God? You see, Noah and Abraham had every reason to trust in God. Yes, there were some things that they didn't understand. There were some things about their faith that they could not see. The bottom line is they had reason to trust in him. So the point is that we shouldn't buy into this definition of faith. In fact, the Bible defines faith as a reasonable trust based on verifiable evidence. Let me give you a couple of examples of that. In the book of John, John chapter 10, Jesus makes a really remarkable statement. Verses 37 and 38, I want you to think about what he's saying here. Jesus is talking to the Jews about his identity as the Christ, and it's pretty clear at this point that the Jews are not going to accept him by and large. And so Jesus is trying to get them to reason. He says in verse 37, "If I do not do works of my Father, do not believe in me." Think about what he's saying there. If there's no evidence that I'm presenting for you to believe in me, don't accept what I say. He's saying, don't believe in me if there's no verifiable objective evidence. But he goes on to say in verse 38, "But if I do them, Though you do not believe me, believe the works, so that you may know and understand that the Father is in me and I in the Father. Jesus did not expect people to just blindly accept whatever he said as if they needed no evidence, they needed no miracles, they needed no reason to believe in him. He didn't expect people to do that. He asked them to look at the evidence. So Jesus himself didn't buy into this definition of faith. And certainly not when it comes to the resurrection. In John chapter 20, we just sang a hymn before the Lord's Supper based on this same account here about Thomas, how he did not believe, he doubted that Jesus really was risen from the dead, and Jesus appeared to him and gave him clear flesh and blood evidence that he really was alive. In verse 27, then Jesus said to Thomas, "Reach here with your finger and see my hands. Reach here with your hand and put it into my side, and do not be unbelieving, but believing." And Thomas answered and said to him, "My Lord and my God." Jesus said to him, "Because you have seen me, have you believed? Blessed are they who did not see and yet believed." So he gave Thomas verifiable evidence of his resurrection. And in an indirect way, we have that same evidence. Verse 30 and 31 talks about the fact that we have these accounts recorded for us, these eyewitness accounts. It says, "Therefore, many other signs Jesus also performed in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book, but these have been written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name." The Bible asks us to look at the evidence, because God has left us with evidence. And Jesus provided the resurrection as the ultimate proof of who he was. We're going to talk about that more tonight as really the crucial point of our faith. But just suffice it to say at this point that faith in God does not involve closing our eyes or closing our minds. It involves opening our eyes and opening our minds to look at the evidence and drawing a logical conclusion. So, is there evidence to believe in God? I would say, yes, there certainly is. I want to give you three reasons to believe, three common sense arguments for the existence of God. The first of these is that only God sufficiently explains the existence of the universe. Only God sufficiently explains the existence of the universe. If we were going to put this in a very strictly logical format, it would be based on three points. The premise is that everything that has a beginning has a cause. The second point is that the world had a beginning. If you put those two premises together, you can draw a conclusion. Therefore, the world has a cause which brought it into existence. Now, let's go back and unpack that, because there's a lot to think about there. First of all, everything that has a beginning has a cause. That's pretty much common sense. Anything that began to exist, anything that was created or made or designed, something had to design it, right? Something had to cause it to exist. That's pretty much common sense. The world had a beginning. Of course, that's the assumption that the Bible makes, the statement that the Bible makes in Genesis chapter 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The world had a beginning. But that's not just the statement that the Bible makes. Did you know that scientists, the general consensus among the scientific community, is that the world is not eternal, that it had a beginning at one point? I mean, the fact that scientists try to put an age on the universe, that whether it was billions of years old or millions of years old, the fact that they try to put a date on it indicates and implies that there was one point at which it did not exist. And a lot of scientists believe that the world began with this Big Bang. Not necessarily that we have to believe that, but what does that imply? If there really was a Big Bang, well, that's a beginning. Who caused that beginning? And the fact that this world is expanding, the universe is expanding, that's something that scientists have looked at as evidence for the fact that the world had a beginning. I think we can conclude that that is certainly true. This third conclusion, or this third point here, the conclusion, is fundamental. If those things are true, if the world had a beginning, who caused it? And I think I want to suggest this morning that only God can sufficiently explain that. That's the affirmation of Paul in Romans chapter 1. Romans chapter 1 and verse 20. Paul says, "For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse." God is the reason for this world. But if we reject that, then we've got to draw a different conclusion, right? We've got to have some alternative. And what is that alternative? Well, again, to quote Richard Dawkins, this is the alternative that he has put forth. And it's a logical alternative, if you base it on his reasoning. He says, "The fact that life evolved out of nearly nothing, some 10 billion years after the universe evolved out of literally nothing, is a fact so staggering that I would be mad to attempt words to do it justice." Now think about that. That's really a head-scratcher, isn't it? He says that the universe evolved out of literally nothing. The alternative to believing that God, or at least an intelligent designer, created and is the reason for this world, the alternative to that is concluding that something came from nothing. And I don't know about you, but that's patently absurd. It doesn't make sense. It does not go hand in hand with common sense. That defies all common reasoning. I'm not willing to accept that alternative. I think it makes a whole lot more sense to conclude that there is someone greater behind this world. Well, at this point, someone may ask the question, well, who made God? If everything that has a beginning needs a cause to create it, then where did God come from? Well, let's back up and understand that we didn't say that everything has a beginning. There are some things that do not have a beginning, and one of those things is God. The Bible presents God as the eternal, infinite creator. And remember in Exodus chapter 3, when God is speaking to Moses, telling him to go down to Egypt and communicate this message to Pharaoh, "Let my people go." God defines himself, names himself. He says, "I am who I am." In other words, God has always existed and he always will. The conclusion from that is that God has no beginning, and therefore he needs no cause. He doesn't need someone to create him because he is God. He is the one who is beyond. He's greater than. He is above his creation. He's the reason for this creation. He doesn't need an explanation necessarily. Now, you might be thinking, well, he's just trying to create a picture of God that just satisfies his own argument. He's just trying to maybe tamper with the evidence. No. This is not us creating a God to fit our preconceptions. This is us properly understanding the God that's described in the Bible. I mean, that's what we're talking about, right? We're talking about the God described in the Bible. He is described in the Bible as an infinite being, one that does not need a beginning. So the first reason I want you to consider is that only God sufficiently explains the existence of the universe. Where else could the world have come from but from God? Reason number two, only God sufficiently explains the complex design of our universe. Not just the fact that our world, our universe exists, but what you see in the universe, the design, the complexity of it. I mean, you don't have to be a scientist to conclude that this world has a lot of complexities to it. On just about every level, you look at the macro level, the biggest level of the universe you can find. The stars, the galaxies, and all of them, the millions and billions of stars that haven't even all been named. There's complexity there. And you drop that down a level and you look at just the complexity in our solar system and the complexity on our Earth. The complexity within our own bodies. The fact that we have systems in our bodies that work so well in conjunction with each other. The respiratory system, the pulmonary system, all of the systems in our body, and you take that down another level and you look at the cells in our body and that they function so well, and you take that down to the DNA level, and then you're talking about something that is just really incredible. The fact that there is DNA that makes every single person who has ever walked this earth different in some way. There's design there, and you go even further than that to the atom level. There is design even within the smallest atom. All those things imply complexity and order and intricacy and, of course, design. And the question is, where does that come from? One line of reasoning that has been put forth along this line is, is the incredible fine-tuning of the universe. In other words, the conditions on this earth being just right to sustain life. Astronomer Ross Hugh writes of this point, the fine-tuning of the conditions of the universe. For example, he talks about the gravitational constant, the measure of gravitational force on Earth. He talks about the nuclear force between protons and neutrons, the velocity of light, the distance from the sun that the Earth is. If all of those factors were just the tiniest increment different, then life couldn't exist here on this Earth. I mean, we're talking about the tiniest increment. We're talking about 1 in like 10 to the 40th power difference. Then life would be impossible. And not only the fact that those things have to be fine-tuned, but they have to be fine-tuned together. All of these variables, all of these things have to be working together, all at the same time, working just right in order to make our existence here on Earth possible. Our existence is delicately balanced on a razor's edge. In other words, if those things were just a little bit different, we'd be falling off of the razor's edge. Is that chance, or is that by design? Let me use more of a personal example to bring this maybe closer to home. When I was 9 years old, my family piled into the car, little Toyota Camry, and we drove out west. And we came to Idaho, to the southern part of the state. We didn't come nearly this far. Well, one of the places that we visited was Mount Rushmore. And I remember being a 9-year-old kid there on the dock, you looking out Mount Rushmore. You can see, I mean, it's an immense rock that's there. I mean, we saw rock climbers climbing on the nose of one of the men. I forget which one. And they were minuscule, just on the nose. That's a magnificent piece of work. Well, how reasonable is it, how logical is it that the faces of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and Abraham Lincoln and Teddy Roosevelt, they just appeared there after a long process of erosion, wind and rain and ice and just, you know, millions of years, their faces just appeared there. How much sense does that make? Well, not very. History tells us that these were sculptures that were sculpted by a gentleman by the name of Gutzon Borglum within history in 1927 to 1941. I think his son was also involved. But the point is that this was an act of someone's creativity. Someone had to design that. Someone had to create that. Now, we can reason like that on that level, but what about when it comes to God? If we can see design in man's work, why can't we see it in God's? If we can see intelligence, if we can see creativity in what we can create as people with our minds and with our hands, why can't we see that with God? And that's the point of this, the second reason to believe in God. It certainly is not accidental that this world has so much design. Just as much as it's not accidental that those faces appear there on Mount Rushmore. In 1802, William Paley wrote a work called Natural Theology, and obviously that was a long time ago, but he said some very pointed things here. He writes that there can be no design without a designer. There can be no order without choice, no arrangement without anyone capable of arranging. I think that's pretty common sense, don't you? And of course, this is what the Bible attests to. The Bible tells us that there is a lot of reason to believe in God just by looking at the world. Think about Psalm 19. Psalm 19, verse 1. You can almost imagine David writing the psalm as he is looking at the stars at night. And he writes, "The heavens are telling of the glory of God, and their expanses declaring the work of his hands." The very fact that we feel so small when we go out on a night, a clear night, and we see the stars, attests to the fact that there is someone greater out there who designed those things. Another psalm that comes to mind is Psalm 139, where the psalmist writes of God's hand in our very design in our mother's wombs. Psalm 139, verses 13 and 14, it says, "For you formed my inward parts, you wove me in my mother's womb. I will give thanks to you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works, and my soul knows it very well." Again, the Bible gives us reason. It gives us testimony. It opens our eyes to see that there is creation out there. There is something that God has left His fingerprint on to show us that, yes, God does exist. So God, only God, sufficiently explains the complex design of our universe. But reason number three, only God sufficiently explains our sense of universal morality. Only God sufficiently explains, in other words, our sense of right and wrong, which we all have. We live in a world today where moral relativism is very popular. This idea that what's right and true for you may not necessarily be right and true for me, and vice versa. We can make our own truth. It's wrong to say you're wrong in that because, you know, who's to define what is wrong? But I think deep down, all of us know that there are certain things that are just simply wrong. Wouldn't you agree with that? There are just some things that we just, as humans, we know in our innermost conscience, they're just wrong. There are lines that we would never, or we understand should not be crossed. Take ethnic genocide, for instance. That has happened. And sad to say, people have tried to justify that. But I think anyone who's in their right mind can conclude that that is wrong. Racism, murder, rape, those are things which we understand in our country. Those things are just simply wrong. But the question is, why are those things wrong? Where does that sense come from? Why do we all understand that deep down those things are wrong? I might ask it this way, you know, so what? Who's to say that those things are wrong? Who's to say that it's wrong for me to hurt someone else or for you to hurt me? Who has the authority to enforce those kinds of values? And where did that sense come from? I'll tell you that without God, there is no really defining what is right and what is wrong. I mean, people have tried to suggest some things about where our sense of morality comes from. But when it comes right down to it, without God, you don't have any objective basis for making an argument for what is truly right and what's wrong. The thing we're talking about this morning is an objective basis. I mean, racism and genocide, those things are just objectively wrong. It's not just that I feel they're wrong. We can objectively say those things are wrong. But where does that objective base come from? And I will tell you that even atheists have gone to the extent, the logical conclusion of their position to agree with this very point. For example, George Gaylord Simpson, in his work called The Meaning of Evolution, this is what he writes. Man is the result of a purposeless and natural process that did not have him in mind. He was not planned. He is a state of matter, a form of life, a sort of animal. And this discovery inevitably means that the workings of the universe cannot provide any automatic, universal, eternal, or absolute ethical criteria of right and wrong. What he's saying is that without God, and we've got evolution left, evolution cannot really tell us what is absolutely right and what is absolutely wrong. From evolution's perspective, we're just atoms bumping together. We're just a process of this mindless, a result of this mindless process of evolution, and there's no objective basis for saying something is wrong in that case. But I will tell you that the only moral law that evolution can put forth is this idea of survival of the fittest. That's one of the basic tenets of evolution, is that whoever is more adapted to their environment, whoever's strongest, who's ever smartest, whoever is the bigger prey, that's the one that's going to survive. But if you apply that to morality, where does that take you? Well, that takes you to a very, very dangerous place. It takes you to a place where Hitler was, where he justified his actions of ethnic genocide based upon the fact, his belief, that the Aryan race, the race that he was a part of, was better and stronger and more morally fit to live than other races. He may not have realized it, and maybe this is a point of debate, but he was basing his beliefs and his actions really upon evolution. The fact that his race was more fit to survive than anyone else's. Now, I hope you don't misunderstand me. That doesn't mean that every atheist is like Hitler. Certainly not. or that every atheist would go to the extreme of saying that. But the point that I'm making is that without God, this is the logical consequence. This is what comes from rejecting the God, a creator God. Basically, what we can say is if I'm bigger, if I'm stronger, if I'm smarter than you, then yes, I'm justified in hurting someone else. And so the point is that rejection of God ultimately leads to a rejection of morality. And this again is something that Paul talks about in Romans chapter 1. In the last few verses of the chapter, Romans chapter 1 verse 28, he's talking about the Gentiles and how they've rejected God and the consequences that have come from that. And just as they did not see fit to acknowledge God any longer, God gave them over to a depraved mind, to do those things which are not proper, being filled with all unrighteousness, wickedness, greed, evil, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malice. They are gossips, slanderers, and haters of God, insolent, arrogant, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, without understanding, untrustworthy, unloving, unmerciful. And although they know the ordinance of God, that those who practice such things are worthy of death, they not only do the same, but also give hearty approval to those who practice them. What Paul is saying is, you look at the world today as it is, and you see all kinds of evil and all kinds of wickedness and all kinds of people hurting people and violence. And where does that come from? Ultimately, he's saying it's coming because people have rejected God. Without God, there is no reason to say something is objectively wrong. And again, I want to be clear on this. This does not mean that all atheists are bad people. I've known atheists who are very kind, very self-sacrificing, and very good people. But the point that I'm making is that without God, there's no objective basis for them to be good, kind people. Because there's no God to teach them that. There's no God to hold them to that standard. So these are three reasons that I want you to think about as being reasons, rational reasons, to believe in God. And when you take these three arguments together, I think you make the best case for God. I think the best explanation or the best argument for God is not just one of these arguments by themselves, but taking them cumulatively. You put them together, and you've got a very strong case for believing in God's existence. It's like if you take a small thread, it's pretty weak. You can cut it, you can tear it, but if you take several pieces of thread and you wind it together, then you've got a strong rope that can't be torn, can't necessarily be cut. And that's what I want you to think about. These three reasons being twisted together, being put together, providing a powerful cumulative argument for believing in God. Well, we haven't talked a whole lot about who this God is. We've just talked about the fact that He exists. But I want to conclude this morning by just thinking about what these arguments tell us about God. The first argument is that without God, nothing can sufficiently explain the existence of this universe. God is a creator, and that tells us that He is powerful. By His word, He simply spoke everything into existence. God is creator, and He's powerful. He's not just a creator. He's a designer. And that tells us He's smart. He's intelligent. He's brilliant. I mean, you take the most brilliant person that you know, and God is a million times more brilliant than that. And then God is a judge. Without God, there is no reason to believe in right or wrong objectively. And there's no reason to believe that anyone's going to hold us ultimately accountable for right and wrong. But if God exists, then He is the ultimate judge. And that tells us that He is a good God. He's not the kind of judge who can be paid off, bribed, convinced into judging wrongly. But He is a good, just God. And the question I want to leave with you this morning is, will you serve Him today? If maybe this lesson has brought up some questions in your mind, that's a good thing. I want you to ask those questions. I want you to think about those questions. But maybe this lesson has caused you to think about serving this God, bowing before your Creator, and recognizing that, yes, He is your Creator. And maybe you understand what you need to do in response to Him, that He has sent His Son Jesus to die on the cross for us, and that He has risen from the dead to give you life And you understand that you need to trust in Him. You need to confess your faith in Him, repent of your sins, and be immersed in water to be put into Christ, to be baptized for the forgiveness of your sins. If you need to do anything spiritually, we're going to sing a song of invitation for you just a moment. If you need to make something known, maybe it's one of those questions that's come in your mind. We'd love to sit down with you and talk with you. Whatever it is, please come to the front and make that known as we stand and sing.